Okay, let's wrap up. Let's wrap up. First thing I want you to do before we even go to Arkin Land and in our final chapter, open your Bible. I don't know what you thought of when you're watching Rabidash become Rabidash the Ridiculous. What a lot of us think of is Daniel chapter 4. So go to Daniel chapter 4. There's a Bible story, and you shouldn't be shocked by this. There's a Bible story, we think, is behind all this episode. And again, this might not have been a Bible story you've gotten with the flannel graphs growing up in Sunday school. It's King Nebuchadnezzar, you know, the Babylonian king who destroyed the first temple, Solomon's temple, who took 25%, the cream of the crop, from Jerusalem into exile to Babylon. This is the guy who built the famous Hanging Gardens of Babylon. Maybe y'all learned that in high school. You can't go there now. They're gone. We don't know where they're at. But he built that. We have literary evidence of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. He is the most prominent pagan king in the Bible. Pagan being the operative word. Mentioned 88 times in the Bible, because he's the one who destroyed Jerusalem. He's the Babylonian emperor. He was probably in his day was the most powerful empire, and that's why he came against Jerusalem. Anyway, you may remember some of that from Sunday school, but I want you to look at what happened to King Nebuchadnezzar because of his pride, his arrogance. The Greek word is hubris, in that pride that sets you up for failure. Anyway, look at chapter 4. Here's what comes of, not the end of his story. This is kind of the middle of his story. Fascinating piece of his story. Here's the mighty King Nebuchadnezzar. Daniel 4, I'm going to be reading verse 28. And by the way, three times in the Old Testament, Nebuchadnezzar is referred to by God as my servant. He was the instrument of judgment that God used to discipline the Jerusalem and destroy the temple. So God can use anybody, anything to bring about his purposes. So, but Nebuchadnezzar is pretty prominent in history, but particularly here. But anyway, Daniel 4, and I probably won't need to connect the dots for you thinking about Rabidash. Chapter 4, beginning of verse 28. This is in the midst of the book of Daniel. It's in the height of Nebuchadnezzar's glorious rule as a Babylonian emperor. Look at verse 28 and following. All this came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. Now you're told what came upon King Nebuchadnezzar. At the end of 12 months, he was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon. And the king answered and said, this is the king talking to himself, is not this great Babylon which I have built my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty? You probably already know the Christian faith and Judaism, Christianity enough, and the Bible enough. No, this ain't going to end well for Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 31, while the words were still in the king's mouth. Now, God had been using him to bring judgment on the Israelite people. But God has a limit. His patience runs out. So there he is parading on top of his building, very, very proud of himself. While the words were still in the king's mouth, there fell a voice from heaven. Almost as if it shows up suddenly to deal with Rabidash. There fell a voice from heaven, O King Nebuchadnezzar. You can hear Yahweh, God, or if you want to hear Aslan at this point, you can hear Aslan. O King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken. The kingdom has departed from you, and you shall be driven from among men. Now watch this. And your dwelling place shall be where? The beast of the field. He's going to start to bray in just a few minutes. And you shall be made to eat grass like an ox. You shall be made to eat grass like an ox. And seven periods of time shall pass over you. You're going to do this for 7 years. You shall be made to eat grass like an ox. And seven periods of time shall pass over you until you know. God's serious about this stuff. Again, C.S. Lewis called it the intolerable compliment. God loves us so much, He may not let us get by with everything. Until you know that the Most High rules the kingdoms, kingdom of men, and gives it to whom He will. So Nebuchadnezzar was a great ruler, but God even orchestrates the activity of Satan sometimes. Verse 33. Immediately, the word was fulfilled against Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven among men, and he ate grass like an ox, and his body was wet with the dew of heaven till his hair grew as long as eagle's feathers, and his nails were like bird's claws. Did y'all get that in Sunday school? Yeah, mighty Nebuchadnezzar. But it ends well. Keep reading. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted my eyes to heaven. End of the day, at the end of the 7 years, we can really be stupid creatures. I guess you know that. At the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up my eyes to heaven, and my reason returned to me. And I blessed the Most High and praised and honored Him who lives forever. For His dominion is an everlasting dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the inhabitants of the earth are accounted as nothing. And He does according to His will among the host of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And none can stay His hand or say to Him, what have you done? I know a few politicians I wish this would happen to. You know, just to bring them down a few notches. Verse 36. At the same time, my reason returned to me. And for the glory of my kingdom, my majesty and splendor returned to me. My counselors and my Lord sought me, and I was established in my kingdom. He's given back His throne. And still more greatness was added to me. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and extol and honor the King of heaven. For all His works are right and His ways are just. And those who walk in pride, He is able to do what? Yeah, humble, abase. Yeah, I didn't know if y'all knew that from Sunday school or not. So you know where C.S. Lewis now is getting this rabidash instance. If he's not, he sure missed a good chance. So what happens to rabidash, most of us think is an allusion to Daniel 4. And God can humble. And that's why the Bible says over and over, humble thyself in the sight of the Lord. Because think about it, we need to humble ourselves. We don't want God to do it for us. Rabidash. We don't want God to do it for us. So we might as well go ahead and learn a little maturity on our own occasionally. So with that, go to the text. Let me say a word about the name Rabidash again, and I want you to put this. Here's what I'm going to want out of you today. I want you to help me put the story together. Then I want you to tell me why King Loon is so amazing, and Rigney, who wrote the book Live Like a Narnian, says it's his favorite character in all the Chronicles. And then I want to just end up summarizing what are your takeaways from this book. But look at the beginning of chapter 15. Rabidash, and we talked about this way back when I sort of talked about the name Rabidash, but again to show you, dash. Now rabid, wild animal, rabid, but dash. C.S. Lewis, and you know this, but we don't use the word anymore, but when C.S. Lewis gave his inaugural address at Cambridge, he'd been at Oxford for 30 years. They would not even give him tenure. So his friend worked it out. His friend J.R.R. Tolkien worked it out for him to get a position at Cambridge. He was able to take the train to Cambridge and keep living there in Oxford. He finished his academic career at Cambridge. But when they gave him an endowed seat and they said, come on to Cambridge, we'll make life good for you and you don't have to move out of Oxford. And it was painful. He'd been 30 years with Oxford, but he wasn't even given tenure because he was too much of a traditional Christian and he was too popular. And anyway, so he goes to Cambridge. Anyway, he gave his, as you would do, and maybe you still do it. A friend of mine just got an endowed, friend of mine who was looking forward to retiring from Duke Divinity School, I think he was going to, is just, they're creating an endowed chair for him, which I don't know what all that means, but I think that makes life so good he can stay there forever and do what he wants to do. Anyway, so when C.S. Lewis went to Cambridge, he had an endowed seat, professorship. He gave his inaugural address called De Descriptione Temporum. Need a good Latin term. He gave it in English. But anyway, in that term, that's where he famously says to these 1954 academics in Cambridge, you know, he says, I'm a dinosaur. You know, if you're smart, you don't discount me. If you're smart and you're really an academic, you need to study the dinosaur. Not a lot of us left. Anyway, but in that speech, he's talking about, he didn't believe there was such a thing as, dark ages were not dark. And everybody agrees with that now. Don't use the phrase dark ages or I'll come at you. Dark ages, Christendom, dark ages were smarter than we were in some ways. So that's why dark ages, we don't use that term anymore. Medieval period. But you know, in his lecture, he talks about being a little careful about saying dark ages. Then all of a sudden they wake up on March the 4th and they say, okay, we're going to be at the Renaissance now. And now we're Renaissance. Anyway, he just talks about how you do history and, you know, some things change, some things don't change. But anyway, in that lecture, he talks about, because we're going to talk about kingship in a minute. I see people, and I'm not making a political statement. I'm not. I see people on sides of roads with signs about kings. They wouldn't recognize a king if one walked up and slapped them in the face. All thing they know is 250 years of American democracy. I don't know what they're, I don't know, anyway. So C.S. Lewis is talking about monarchy and kingship and history and what changes. And he says, now we prefer leaders who are winsome, magnetic, have great personalities, and they have dash. We used to use that word. You still know about dashing. Errol Flynn, a dashing person. Yeah, so we used to talk about dashing, dash personality. But C.S. Lewis said, yeah, we want rulers who have magnetism, you know, magnetism, personality. They can win a crowd and they have dash. Yeah, charisma. As opposed to what he said in that talk, as opposed to wanting leaders that have integrity and they're incorruptible and they're just King Loon. Anyway, so dash, I'm teaching some old English here. We used to talk about, you know, a dashing person. You are dashing. You look dashing. A dash. So Rabidash. Again, you don't even have to read the story and you figure out about Rabidash. And he proves his name over and over again. So here's the end. So what you have going on here is any remaining conflicts are resolved in here. So, you know, you've got Bree, Wynn, Erebus. They're going to Arkin. They're going to Arkinland to Anvard. You know, Shasta's is up in Narnia. Well, he's actually here waiting on them, which is actually south of Narnia. So they show up. So take it from there. When they show up, you know, next turn of the road brought them out from among the trees and there across green lawns, sheltered from the north wind by the high wooded ridge. As back, they saw the castle of Anvard. It was very old and built of warm reddish stone. Okay, so the king comes out. What happens? Take the story, and I'm going to do a little bit of reading in a minute, but set the stage. King comes out and does what? Yeah, he does not look like he's not pretentious because he's been dealing with what? His kennels. He has to wash his doggy hands. But he bows before Erebus. Honorable, not pretentious. Comes out. Little lady, we bid you a very heartily welcome if my dear wife were still alive. We could make you better cheer, but could not do it with a better will, and I am sorry that you have misfortunes. Watch Ervis here. I'm sorry that you've had misfortunes, have been driven from your father's house, which cannot be but a grief to you. My son Cor has told me all about your adventures together with all your valor. You see Ervis's response? Get the transformation going on. It was he who did all that, sir. Why, he rushed a line to save me. Yeah, that's not the early Ervis who didn't like Shasta. But now she's seeing things differently. Anyway, they have this conversation. They're here talking. Queen Lucy shows up. And then Queen Lucy and Ervis go away and they do girls' things. But then all of a sudden, King Rabadash says, we have still that sorry creature Rabadash on our hands. Because remember what happened? He's in prison. What are we going to do about Rabadash? What are some of the options as presented to King Loom? Kill him. Peredan says, strike off his head. Yeah, but by the way, notice what Edmund says, where it says, your majesty would have a perfect right, this is Peredan, your majesty would have a perfect right to strike off his head, said Peredan. Such an assault as he made puts him on a level with an assassin. Did you catch what Edmund said? It is very true, said King Edmund. But even a traitor may mend. I have known one that did. And Edmund looked very thoughtful. Who's Edmund talking about? Edmund. If you don't know the line, The Witch in the Wardrobe, maybe you'll go read it. He was pretty much, when they first went to Narnia, he was a traitor. He got under the control of the White Witch, and he was lying to his siblings, and Aslan dealt with them. So when you know, you don't have to have read that to have read this, but this is hearkening you back to that. Edmund was changed, transformed. So he says, but even a traitor may mend. I have known one that did. And he looked very thoughtful. Yeah, he's talking about himself. So we'll read the other chronicles. Why does Loon not want to kill Rabadash? He could create a war with the Tizrock. But then he says, though, a fig for the Tizrock. I had to think about that one a little bit. I guess that means who cares about the Tizrock? So it's not about, and I don't know that I understand this, a fig for the Tizrock, his strength is in numbers, and numbers will never cross the desert. But see the next phrase? This is King Loon. But I have no stomach for killing men, even traitors in cold blood. To have cut his throat in battle, it's a different thing. To have cut his throat in battle would have eased my heart mightily. That's a different thing. He's a POW now. He's not in battle. By the way, in case you don't know your medieval history or early modern history, he's nobility. Rabadash is nobility. He was crown prince. I'm sure I've told you. I haven't. I'll tell you. Again, I'm a direct descendant of the Earls of Kildare who ruled Ireland on behalf of the Tudor monarchy, such as Henry VII and Henry VIII, the Fitzgeralds, until they ran afoul of the Fitzgeralds. I mean, ran afoul of Henry VIII. And one of them started the first Irish revolt in the 1534, Irish revolt. First time, because he thought that Henry had killed his dad, which actually didn't happen, but they didn't have email back then. And he thought that Henry had called his dad back to London to give an account of how he was ruling. Henry VIII, it was cheaper to get Irish people to rule Ireland than to send an army over there. So his son, Thomas, decided to start the first Irish revolt against Tudor England. It did not end well. But anyway, on February the 3rd, 1537, after the revolt did not end well, Thomas, who was the Earl of Kildare, because his dad did get killed eventually, he was not dead when the revolt started. But in they did have to, they were taken to London. So Henry VIII took Thomas and four or five of his uncles, Fitzgeralds, to London. They put them in Tower of London. I don't know what you think about when you visit the Tower of London. I think about my family in the Tower of London. They took them to London. But when Henry said, execute them, the four uncles were hanged, drawn, quartered, burned. That's the way you did it back then. Now, Thomas, because he was the acting Earl of Kildare, who started the revolt, he was nobility. So he just got his head chopped off. You treat nobility differently than you treat the peons out there. Rabidash is being treated well. Did you notice that? Rabidash is being treated well. And again, part of that, even in the modern world, goes back to how you take care of prisoners of war. You know, Geneva Conventions, all that stuff. Anyway, Rabidash. So I'll send you a bill later for that history lesson about my families. But nobility or notice how King Loon's doing it. King Loon is honorable. There's a lot about King Loon. Anyway, look at, but watch Rabidash 2:14. I do want to read this little piece. Rabidash was brought before him in chains. You see where I'm at? Rabidash. Rabidash was brought before them in chains. To look at anyone would have supposed that he had passed the night in a noisome dungeon without food or water, but in reality, he had been shut up in a quite comfortable room and provided with an excellent supper. There's mercy here. Maybe not so much in Calorum, but there's mercy here because of King Loon. But as he was sulking far too furiously to touch the supper and had spent the whole night stamping and roaring and cursing, he naturally did not look at his best when he showed up this morning. Yeah, poor Rabidash is just, there's so much to not like about this man. Your Royal Highness, see how King Loon addresses him? Respect. Respect. Our culture needs to learn respect again. I don't care if you're Rabidash. I'm going to talk to you respectfully. Your Royal Highness needs not to be told, said King Loon, that by the law of nations, as well as by all reasons of prudent policy, we have as good right to your head as ever one mortal man had against another. Nevertheless, in consideration of your youth and the ill nurture, he was raised in Calorman, devoid of all gentleness and courtesy, he's not a gentleman in the pure sense of that word, and courtesy, which you have doubtless had in the land of slaves and tyrants. Yeah, King Loon, how do you feel about Calorman? In the land of slaves and tyrants, we are disposed to set you free unharmed on these conditions. And as soon as Rabidash hears the word conditions, he just goes ballistic. Curse you for a barbarian dog, spluttered Rabidash. Do you think I'll even hear your conditions? Fall, you talk very largely of nurture, and I know not what is easy to a man in chains. Ha, take off these vile bonds, give me a sword, and let all of you who dare then debate with me. He's not a smart man. Nearly all the lords sprang to their feet, but not King Loon. Nearly all of the lords sprang to their feet, and Corin shouted, Father, can I box him? Please. Peace, your majesties, my lords, says King Loon. Have you no more... How do you go look up this... Jeb, how do you look up this word? Have you no more gravity among us than to be so chafed by the tone of a what? I went and looked that one up because I'm like, I probably can figure it out. He's referring to Rabidash as a pajock, pajock, whatever. It's an old English word that you shouldn't even know, except it occurs in Hamlet. It occurs in Hamlet. Jack knew Shakespeare. It occurs in Hamlet. And it means a sort of vain, foolish person. Yeah, pajock. Go use that word on somebody today. Just, yeah, you know, so he says, you know, have we no more gravity among us than to be so chafed by the tone of a pajock? Sit down, Corin, and or shalt leave the table. I ask your highness again. He's still talking to Rabdash. I ask your highness again to hear our conditions. And here comes Rabdash. I hear no conditions from barbarians and sorcerers, said Rabdash. Not one of you dare touch a hair of my head. Every insult you have leaped on me shall be paid with oceans of Narnian and Arkanlandish blood. Terrible shall the vengeance of the Tisrock be even now. But kill me and the burnings and torturings in these northern lands shall become a tale to frighten the world 1,000 years hence. Beware, beware, beware. The bolt of Tash, that's their pagan god, falls from above. You know, I'm sure these Arkanlanders are rolling their eyes at this point, but it's quite a spectacle. Does it ever, and look what Corin does. Corin, they start laughing at him. You know, they come out to the bolt of Tash falling from above. Does it ever get caught on a hook halfway? What's the reference to? Yeah, Rabdash getting caught and hanging there and flailing about as a spectacle. And notice what King Loon says to his son. Shame, Corin. Watch this. Never taunt a man, save, except when he's stronger than you. Then as you please. But yeah, the poor guys, don't kick him when he's down. Oh, you foolish Rabdash. Now watch this. Next moment, Kor wondered. Shasta, Kor wondered why everyone at the table had risen. I can hear them standing up. Everyone stands up, perfectly still. Of course, he did the same himself. And then he saw the reason. Who has shown up? Aslan was among them, though no one had seen him coming. Rabdash started as the immense shape of a lion paced softly in between him and his accusers. So Aslan's just sort of walking over to Rabdash. Rabdash, says Aslan, take heed. Your doom is very near, but you may still avoid it. Feel the mercy of Aslan, but you may still avoid it. Forget your pride. What have you to be proud of? And your anger, who has done you wrong? And accept the mercy of these good kings. I love the next line. Then Rabdash rolled his eyes. Never a good thing to roll your eyes at Aslan. You know, the thing that made me the angriest when I was raising teenagers, they could debate me, they could argue, don't roll your eyes at me. That just, for whatever reason, sent me into orbit. Then Rabdash rolled his eyes and spread out his mouth into a horrible, long, mirthless grin, like he wants to mock Aslan, like a shark. And he wagged up his ears. This is a hint of what's coming. Watch what Jack tells you. Wagged his ears up and down. By the way, in case you don't know, anyone can learn how to do this if they take the trouble. Sure you're wondering about if you could learn to wag your ears. He had always found this very effective in Kalorm, and the bravest had trembled when he made these faces, and ordinary people had fallen to the floor, and senseless people had often fainted. But what Rabdash hadn't realized is that it is very easy to frighten people who know you can have them boiled alive the moment you give the word. The grimaces didn't look at all alarming in Arkanland. Indeed, Lucy only thought Rabdash was going to be sick. And look, but Rabdash continues. Look what he calls Aslan. Demon, 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 shrieked the prince. I know you. You are the foul fiend of Narnia. They'd heard about this god of Narnia. You are the enemy of the gods. Learn who I am, horrible phantasm. I am descended from the pagan god Tash, the inexorable, the irresistible. The curse of Tash is upon you. Lightning in the shape of scorpions shall be rained on you. The mountains of Narnia shall be ground to dust. I just said, shut up, Rabdash. Aslan, not surprising, just says, have a care, Rabdash, said Aslan quietly. The doom is nearer now. It is at the door. Yeah, remember what was said by God to Cain. The sin is crouching at your door. And if you don't get control, it may have its way with you. Anyway, have a care. The doom is nearer now. It is at the door. It has lifted the latch. You know, Rabbi Dash, you need to figure this out. I'm Aslan. These other kings are in control. Let the skies fall, shrieked Rabbi Dash. Let the earth gape. Let blood and fire obliterate this world. But be sure I will never desist until I have dragged to my palace. Remember this? By her hair, the barbarian queen. And that's what started all this. He wanted Lucy. And Lucy didn't want him, so he's gone after her like Helen of Troy. The daughter of dogs. And by this point, Aslan has lost his patience. The hour has struck, said Aslan. And Rabbi Dash saw now, to his supreme horror, that everyone's begun to do what? Because what is starting to happen to Rabbi Dash? He starts turning into a donkey or an ass. King James would call him an ass. That's what he starts turning into. Now, I don't know about you. What I always think of when I read this text, I bet none of you know this. Do you remember the movie that came out in 1981? It actually became almost a cult classic. The American Werewolf in London. Oh, I love that movie. David Naughton is one of the two main characters. They're backpacking through England, and they don't listen to the advice, and they get off the main road, and they go down through the moors, and a werewolf attacks them. One is killed, but David is bitten. Well, this is 1981, and this was a big deal back then. I was dating back then, so I like went to movies. That's where, and you pull it up, you can get off. That's where, and this was a big deal in 1981, the special effects of David turning into the werewolf. It's amazing. Any of you remember that? You remember that? Amazing special effects. That's right. He was Dr. If you don't know who David Naughton was, he was a Dr. Pepper guy. Anyway, I don't know what you were doing in 1981. I was at Duke Divinity School and trying to find a wife. But anyway, I was dating. I'm sure I took Tammy to see American Werewolf in London. You can still pull it off. Pull it off YouTube. It is weird. It in a lot of ways. Anyway, that's what I see here. Because here's this transformation. And you can just about visualize, you know, he's turning into a donkey. And everyone's laughing louder and louder because they couldn't help it. For now, what had been Rabbi Dash was simply and unmistakably a donkey. And by the way, the Latin word for donkey is asinus, from which you get the word ass, from which you get the word asinine. Yeah, don't be asinine. That's the Latin word for donkey. Anyway, and then Aslan will say, now that he's turned into a donkey, and he actually, at the top of page 219 in my edition, his words died away into a donkey's bray. He's trying to talk, probably trying to talk quick, get his words out, and the more he's trying to talk, he starts sounding like a donkey. Yaw, yaw, yaw. So then, notice what Aslan says, now hear me, Rabbi Dash. And it's a beautiful theology here. This is the cross, by the way. Justice shall be mixed with mercy. The cross is where love and judgment meet, where the love and judgment of God meet, where both are accomplished, where both are satisfied. So if you're part of the modern culture that just thinks it's all about love, but no judgment, the cross is how God's love and judgment meet. Both are satisfied. The price is paid. So here's Aslan being Aslan, the Christ figure, justice shall be mixed with mercy. You shall not, watch this, you shall not always be an ass. He's so gentle and gracious and loving and kind. He's Narnian. The Narnians are like this. So what, and then Aslan disappears. What is the merciful part about him being turned into a donkey? How does he get out of it? Yeah, he has to go back home. Watch this. Aslan says, go back to Kilorman. Go back home. Go back to the temple of your God. And the temple of your God will do what for him? Will change him back to a man. Now, but there's a caveat, there's a catch. He'll be turned back into a man unless he does what? Gets further than 10 miles away from Kalorman or Tashbon. If he gets further than 10 miles away from his home, he'll turn back in. Now, what does that accomplish? For no more wars for Rabadash. But not only no more wars for Rabadash, he's confined to within a 10 mile because he'll turn back into a donkey. He goes back and he's the crown prince. He starts ruling. But his people, and I think he said thousands, his people saw him return as a donkey. And even though he turned back into a man who became their king, their Tisrach, it's hard to forget that image of a donkey. So he rules, and they start calling him, you notice, Rabadash the Peaceful, or Rabadash the Peaceable, or whatever, because he can't do war. Because if he gets more than 10 miles away from his kingdom, he'll turn back into a donkey. Now, they called him Rabadash the Peaceable, or Peaceful, to his face. What did they call him behind his back? Yeah, Rabadash the Ridiculous. And in the schools of Tashbon, he's their ruler now, in the schools of Tashbon, when somebody did something stupid, really stupid, what were they called? A second Rabadash. Kind of like Benedict Arnold. Yeah, bless your heart. Benedict Arnold. I mean, there was a lot of good about Benedict Arnold. He just thought he wasn't being treated well by the colonials, so he jumped ship. But, you know, I bet you're not going to name your child Benedict Arnold Smith. You're not going, that's just a name that we, or Judas is not real popular anymore. There's certain, yeah, so when people acted stupid, the teachers would say, not in Rabadash, the Tisrach's hearing, but would say, you're acting like a second Rabadash. So Aslan has accomplished a lot here. He's been merciful, but he's judged. He's been merciful, but he has intervened, and Narnia and Arkanland will not have to worry again about Rabadash trying to lead an invasion of those countries. Now, two things I want to show you as we'll wrap up. We're in the last couple pages of the book. Who's going to be the new king in Arkanland? I learned something. I went and Googled this because I didn't know this. Kor is going to be the king, not Corwin, the brother. They're twins. But why is Kor going to be king? He was born 20 minutes before. Now, God would never have trusted me with two children at one time. So I didn't have twins. Now, when Tammy was expecting, my great-grandmother came from a family of 10, and in those 10, there were two sets of twins. So when Tammy got pregnant, I didn't really say it to her, but I had a little period of anxiety. Well, because her dad comes from seven brothers, which includes a set of twins. So I'm like, dear God, I'll trust you and whatever, but don't give me twins, please. Don't give me twins. Anyway, so I don't know. But I went, yeah, twins, y'all probably know this. Any of you have twins that you've birthed? I went and looked it up, thanks to, you know, artificial intelligence. Twins usually are born 15 to 20 minutes apart. I figured they just popped out right after each other. But they are born 15, 20, that's what AI says, 15, 20 minutes apart. So, yeah, so that's, so, yeah, Core is 20 minutes earlier. Say what?
11:45 and 12:15.
I guess. They could have two different birthdays, if it's depending on what time it is. Anyway, so Kor is going to be the king. Kor is just learning what it means to be a child of the king. He certainly doesn't know how to be a king. He was raised in Kalorim. He's going to be the king. And of course, Koran is happy because kings are not the ones who have all the fun. Who has all the fun? The princes. And this is where you get this is one of my favorite statements ever penned about leadership. You know, when King Lung is telling his son Cor, you're going to be king. And Cor says, I don't want to. King's daddy says, I don't care what you want. It's about duty. It's about obligation. It's about honor. And then one of the best definitions, this is page 223, close to the end, where King Lung says, King Lung defines what it means to be a king. Again, this is not the definition I see people thinking about when they're on the side of the road holding. You know, we all had kings for a really long time. Monarchy is the government in the Bible. You don't find democracy in the Bible. I assume you know that, right? When Saul and the people of Israel went to God, they said, give us a king. So that's why throughout most of human history, we've had kings, good ones and bad ones. So, you know, don't be too arrogant against the rest of the world that has kings. That's the way we did human history, and that's because it came, the divine rights of kings. God created kings. I love to irritate my political children by saying, and if you're watching, I love both of you, but I love to irritate my political children by saying the best form of government, I agree with most of Western civilization, I agree with Plato, the best form of government, if we could create it, is a good, benevolent monarchy. I just love to irritate people who think Jesus created democracy. Democracy can be real messy because our founding fathers told us democracy will not work unless you have a moral population. And that's why the human history didn't think much. Your founding fathers scared death of, we were a republic, not a democracy. That's why until the 1840s, 1850s, you couldn't vote in most states unless you owned property. You had to have investment. Anyway, you don't need a civics lesson, but I just love to blow people's... Yeah, people think Jesus, you know, the 13th... You know, go back to Moses. The 11th commandment is, thou shalt be a democracy. You know, there's no perfect form of government. Anyway, here, King Lung, and this would be for politics. This is any kind of leaders. But notice what King Lung says when he says, this is what it means to be a king. If you own a couple sentences as to what it means to be a leader, how you should lean, this is lead, this is perfect. For this is what it means to be a king, to be first in every desperate attack, and last in every desperate retreat. And when there's hunger in the land, as must be now and then in bad years, you wear the finer clothes and you laugh louder over a scantier meal than any man in your land. That's the way he defines what it means to be a good king, good leader, good ruler, whatever. So watch this, flesh out that definition for me as what it means to be. I hope you like King Lung a lot. This is the only time in Chronicles of Narnia he appears. Have you fallen in love with King Lung? What's he telling us about the way, if you're going to do leadership, what's got to be your characteristics?
To be a servant.
Servant. Notice King Lung is very clear. He's under the law. You have to be a servant. You're the first one in the battle and the last one in the retreat. You're there to serve. Lead by example. First one in the battle, last one at the retreat. Yeah, sounds rather Christian. Keep going. Give me some more. Because I want some of y'all to run for government. Give me some more characteristics. We have a very famous Methodist pastor who he and I have kind of diverged in the last 10 years. Adam Hamilton, I'm sure you know. I had churches that read all of him. He is now running for Congress. Kansas has a Democrat. Yeah, I don't know Adam Hamilton. I've been in a few rooms with him. I want to say, you know, if you get elected to Congress, that is a demotion from ministry, in my mind. Nothing against politicians. Anyway, God bless his heart. He's leaving that great church and he's running. He may be if he's the first Democrat elected out of Kansas, might be the first Democrat elected to Congress in, 100 years out of Kansas?
He was the first big guy, not disaffiliated.
Oh, yeah. And he came at the rest of us. Hard time. But anyway, I want some of you to run for office. We need some people like King Loon running for office. It's not about what King, and think about what he told his son. It's not about what you want. A core value of leadership, a monarchy, and there's you've seen a beautiful example of this for 70 years. When you're leading, you are not your own. And one of the best examples of that, and I was in Scotland when she died in Scotland, one of my heroes of the modern era, who was very clear, she was never her own. Who was that? Queen Elizabeth. Now, some of her children have had an issue with that. It's not about what you want, when you want it, how you want it. When you become monarch, you no longer belong to yourself. You're under the law. You are there for the people. This is good stuff from King Loon here. So I hope a lot of kids are reading this, and some of them will grow up and enter into leadership. For this is what it means to be a king, to be first in every desperate attack and last in every desperate retreat. And when there's hunger in the land, and again, Queen Elizabeth knew exactly, she was the symbolic center of Great Britain. That's why she is a little... You didn't see her many times step out of character, because she was a symbol for the people. She symbolized something other than Elizabeth Windsor. She symbolized something. And that symbolism did something for the people. So when there's hunger in the land, as there has to be from time to time, you put on your best clothes and you laugh. Rigney, who wrote the book, Live Like a Narnian, who says, King Loon's his favorite character in all the Chronicles. He says that he likes to joke, he's a descendant of King Loon. He says the way you define King Loon is first in, last out, laugh loudly. You know, even if you're in the midst of a famine. You ever notice Queen Elizabeth? You ever notice her dresses? She never wore black. Why did she always have like a bright pastel colored dress on? So people could pick her out. Because she was a symbol for those people. When you didn't want to keep a stiff upper lip, look at her. You know, and that was always the history of the monarchy. That's why, you know, I'm sure Winston Churchill, when he said, London was being bombed, Great Britain's being bombed by the Nazis, and, you know, C.S. Lewis. Winston Churchill said, don't ever retreat, never retreat, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We'll fight them all over the place. And the only thing I can promise you is blood, sweat, and tears. Keep a stiff upper lip. That famous poster that came out of World War II, be calm and carry on. If you didn't know how to do that, look at King George, Elizabeth's father. So yeah, I mean, there's something to symbolism, what you present in front of people, being an example. This is good stuff. You know, we used to know this in Western civilization. So I hope you love King Loon. Now, to show you how it ends, because it's really rather funny, right? What happens in the last paragraph? Get married. They were so used to quarreling, and this was before C.S. Lewis met Joy Davidman. He was a confirmed bachelor. It's about the time he's getting correspondence from her. They were so used to quarreling and making up again that they got married so as to go on doing it more conveniently. C.S. Lewis was heavily, heavily, heavily influenced by C.K. Chesterton. So I've got written beside this in my edition, G.K. Chesterton, who was a satirist, great thinker, devout Christian, who was a critic of culture. G.K. Chesterton, who was married, said, marriage is a duel to the death which no man of honor should decline. I'm sure Jack's thinking about that when he says, Erebus, because this is what you've seen through the whole book. Erebus and Chastacor are very different people. So yeah, they finally just marry each other so they can quarrel more conveniently. And then after King Loon's death, they made a good king and queen of Arkenland. And Ram the Great, the most famous of all the kings of Arkanland, was their son. And then what about Bree and Wynn? They got married, but not to each other. They were friends. Yeah, I think they would have killed each other. But they were friends, but they got married, but not to one another. And there weren't many months in which one or both of them didn't come trotting over the grass to visit their friends at Anvard. He's too good an author, but he could have easily said, and they live happily forever after or whatever. Anyway, what's your takeaways from this book? What have you learned? What do you want to keep on? What do you want to hold on to? How's it made you think about your Christian faith? He got some humility. You know, he learned to roll in the grass. I hope he didn't go in, you know, to Arkanland or Narnia and just spend all of his days worrying about what people thought about him. Yeah, you know, he had that docked tail. Yeah. Aslan's behind all our stories.
Behind all the protection of them on the journey.
He's protecting us even we don't know it. You know.
Not the gal to be scratched, but not fatally. Yeah. That was a good lesson.
By the way, I'm leaving here to go to the dentist. I think I lost a crown last night. So I will go and let them hurt me. And they will not harm me, but I will go and let them hurt me. They're working me in, so I'm like, thank you. Because if it starts hurting, I can become a real antagonistic preacher when I have a toothache. So, yeah. The providence of God is so amazing. When we sing through many dangers, toils, and snares, we should pause and think, there's been a lot of dangers, toils, and snares he's led me through that I didn't even know I was on the edge of the cliff. And he stood between me and the ravine. You know, I went online. If you don't know this, at the Museum of the Bible, which I highly recommend in Washington, D.C. for so many reasons, they actually have a theater and Logos Group down out of South Carolina goes there and does productions of the Chronicle of Narnia beginning in September through sometime in October. They're doing Prince Caspian. But they've done The Horse and His Boy. And I went online and looked at a little bit of interviews. They had a perfect Shasta. Had a perfect Erebus. Yeah, if you ever get a chance, we actually, some of us talked to Logos, that theater group, because, you know, they're from South Carolina and Washington, D.C.'s up there. So I thought they have to kind of come through here going back home. Straight down 85, that was our brilliant. And they said, oh yeah, we will come and put on one of the Chronicles of Narnia for you at $40,000. And I'm like, I'll go to the Museum of the Bible. And if you ever get a chance, go to the Museum of the Bible for lots of reasons, but go and catch a production. I don't know what the tickets cost, but they are doing Prince Caspian because the Museum of the Bible is amazing, wonderful. I get no royalties. Amazing, wonderful, and it's even good for children. Children is good for children and adults. There is one floor that is a museum, really, literally, of the Bible, and you get to learn a lot about how we got the Bible, where it came from, different manuscripts. I don't know how many children like that, but you got biblical villages. One of the things I went to, because they change, is, you know, I guess it was like IMAX. I went and I pretend like I was holding on to something will make me fly around Washington, D.C., you know, all around Washington, D.C. They tell you don't do it if you have a, you know, queasy stomach. But what I flew around to see was all of the scripture that is engraved on all of our buildings in Washington, D.C. Yeah, our forefathers thought about this and stuff.
I wanted to ask you, I heard one commentator say that this book was written sort of autobiographically by C.S. Lewis because of his life.
Well, you know, it was hard. You know, you think about his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, which is subtitled The Shape of My Early Life. It's his autobiography, but it's just up to his conversion. Now, again, he grew up in a Christian home, but World War II happened.
Well, he'd actually kind of drifted away before World War II and teenage rebellion. Then World War II happened. Everybody became dark and pessimistic and nihilistic and after World War II. And then he became brilliant. He was brilliant already. Became brilliant. So he made that journey through. He had stages: naturalism, Platonism, idealism. He tried everything in the book. And that's why he says, you know, when he came to believe in God, he said, I was the most dejected, reluctant convert in all of England that night. When he knelt in his office, his study, there at Magdalen College, and he said, I decided to let God be God. And then a little bit later, he actually embraces Christ. But yeah, he was dragged. And he said in his autobiography, he felt like, think about the scratches, he said, looking back after he finally came to God and then Jesus Christ, he said he felt like something had been pursuing him for decades. And, you know, and he said he felt that, and the reason he did not want to embrace Christianity was he didn't want to be, he didn't like being pursued, but he definitely didn't want to be captured. You know, he knew that if he yielded to God, God would just want to interfere with his life and intervene and change. You know, I wish God would have got him to drink less alcohol and smoke a little less. He'd have lived longer. But even with that, because he was very British, very 1950s and 1960, Walter Hooper, who knew him best, said he was the most converted man he had ever met. He was giving away his royalties. He took care of Mrs. Moore, who was the devil incarnate. On so many, he was one of the most, you know, again, not perfect. You know, God, he left a little work for God to do after God took him to heaven. But, you know, from his conversion in 1930, maybe 1929, from his conversion till his death in 1963, he became an amazing trophy of God's grace, which is, again, that's why Oxford would not give him tenure. He became such a trophy of God's grace. This is probably his autobiography. Because when somebody asked him one time, what are all the Chronicles about? And he gave one sentence answers. He said this one is the carrying of the gospel to the heathens. You know.
You can sort of see your own journey through life to heaven.
It is about a journey and appreciating the journey, even through many dangers, toils, and snares. I have already come. That's all part of the journey. You know, life's not, from a Christian point of view, life is not meant to be a walk in the park. And I have to watch this because I didn't have the privilege of serving the military, but a better analogy for life, from a Christian point of view, is boot camp. Now, I hear that's pretty tough for those of you that have experienced boot camp. It is a training. It's about training. It's about change. It's about transformation. American Christians even need to remember this again because we've changed on this one. I want my best life now, and, you know, I love pleasure and comfort. Except, yeah. The reason we don't come to Christ and go straight to heaven is he leaves us here to be a trophy of his grace to other people so people can look at us and see the work of Christ. But also, he wants us to become more and more like Jesus and that to be displayed to the world. And, you know, if he doesn't bother us, we probably will not on our own become more and more like Jesus. Anyway, this is great. I got to go to the dentist. They're working me in at 11 o'clock. So pray that I will be devoutly Christian if they hurt me. Because I know they're helping me. Yeah, so let's pray together. God, we give you thanks for all the ways that you try to mature us, grow us up. We give you thanks for all your amazing grace and your amazing work in our lives. And God, we confess that sometimes we're a little oblivious to what you're doing around us, what you're doing within us, even what you're doing in the world. But God, give us grace-filled eyes to see you at work. Give us ears to hear your voice so that we may find joy in the journey.
we may find the joy that you've planned for us in Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen. Thank you for the summer. We'll start back with Isaiah in the fall. I'll get to